Welcome back, Left Reckoners. I'm Matt Leck. With me, as always, David Griscom. Hello, David.
Hey, man. How's it going?
It's going well. And joining us today is Lee Phillips. Lee is an author, journalist, and science writer. You find his work at Nature, Scientific American, New Scientist, Guardian, Telegraph, co-author of The People's Republic of Walmart with Michal Rozwarski, and author of what we're talking about today, Austerity Ecology and the Collapse Porn Addicts, a defense of growth, progress, industry, and stuff. Lee, thanks for joining us.
Hi there. Hi, guys. Glad to be here. Happy Canada Day.
Happy Canada Day.
I mean, we're really excited to have you on the program today, and I think we're going to get to a lot of subjects, but one thing that really, one of the reasons I really wanted to have you on was because, you know, we've been doing a lot on the environmental movement and sort of trying to chart out a path as to like what a socialist future might look like. And, you know, we're seeing here in Texas in particular, you know, a lot of these fights are becoming very, very real. You know, questions about having the electricity turn on when it's freezing, or even hell, right now when it's 100 degrees plus, making sure that the grid doesn't fail and people cook to death. It's really not only brought the reality of the threat of climate change up to the forefront, but also for me has started to make me very worried, because so much of the fight that we've been having on the question of environmentalism and green movement has been, well, do you believe the science or do you not believe the science, et cetera, et cetera, right? And the reality is now is that things are being done, and it starts to become just as much of an important question of, are we going to do something, as the question is, like, what are we going to do, is going to be. And I think that us on the left, like, need to start becoming a little bit more committed to actually starting to work through some of these systems, because we're talking nothing, you know, short of the way that we power our homes and power our society.
Yeah.
And I appreciate your work so much with that, because I think you take those questions really seriously. And I think it's something that is a very much a breath of fresh air in the environmental movement. But before we get into the book, I did want to start on one specific question, and that's the question of nuclear power, which I think, you know, there's a lot of baggage and history around it. And I think on our side, I think there needs to be a very serious revisiting of some of those questions around nuclear power. But maybe before we get too far ahead of ourselves, could you just maybe lay just like the very bare minimum, you know, set the stage a little bit as to why we really need nuclear power if we want to pursue any kind of serious transition?
Sure. So basically, for any modern society, in order for our hospitals to run their, you know, ventilators or dialysis machines, for our schools to have the lights on, for our factories to be able to process all the materials that they need to process, the electricity needs to be available when those processes are needing to occur. We need a 24/7 electricity grid. We don't need one that is, we can't wait for the sun to shine or the wind to blow to turn on the ventilators at the hospitals. That's elementary. That's not something that's absolutely something necessary in a capitalist society, but it's also something that's necessary in any social society, if anything, because we would have a lot more, you know, social services, a lot more hospitals, public healthcare. One would think that, if anything, we would need this more, or rather that the reliability of electricity is, if anything, even more essential in a socialist society. So that's just straightforward. The problem with wind and solar are fantastic. Similarly, wave, tidal, other forms of variable renewable energy, because they're clean, they don't emit, or they have very low carbon emissions. The problem with them is that they're weather dependent, that they're not available 24/7. So in order to have a reliable grid, we have to make sure that there's another part of the grid that generates clean electricity, but is available 24/7 to match the wind and solar, other variable resources, when the weather isn't working in our favor. And we basically have three options here, or three main options. We have hydroelectricity, we have geothermal, and we have nuclear. All three of those are super low, have super low carbon emissions. In general, I mean, it depends. There are some forms of hydroelectricity which have higher emission profiles, generally in the in the tropics, but that's another story. More importantly with hydroelectricity and with geothermal is that they're geographically constrained. Mm-hmm. So I live in British Columbia, where there are lots of mountains and valleys. So we have a 98% clean electricity grid, one of the cleanest large economy grids in the world, thanks to the fact that we can fill those valleys with, we can dam those valleys, fill them with water, and we've got clean electricity on demand. In the prairies, which is flat, you can't have hydroelectricity. Similarly, geothermal, you need to basically be in a region which is geologically active. And again, that is not the case everywhere. So the Pacific Rim is great for that, but elsewhere in the middle of the continent, not so much. You can extend the geography that is available for geothermal by using something called enhanced geothermal systems, but that involves hydraulic fracturing. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the green left is very opposed to fracking. So that's a challenge. And then finally, we have a nuclear, which you can, which is not geographically constrained. You can use nuclear anywhere in the world. So in those places where you have geographical constraints that don't allow you to use a geothermal or hydroelectricity, nuclear has to be part of the mix.
Mm. Yeah, I mean... And I mean, I think most people, you know, there's a hesitation around nuclear, and I don't think it's necessarily completely misplaced. I think one of them is like maybe a little bit more squishy in the sense that it's just like, oh, this is like a big machine and it's a little scary and I might not really understand the process here. But there is a very, you know, understandable worry when you have seen disasters like Chernobyl or Fukushima out there, where people are worried about having those in their communities. I mean, could you give people a little bit of a sense about one, the technological advances that have happened in nuclear plants in recent decades, and sort of speak to the issue of the question of, you know, of disaster that I think makes a lot of people a little bit allergic to the concept of powering their society through nuclear.
Yeah. And can I just tack on there, you know, I remember hearing a lot of engineers talk about like the low risk of certain pipelines only for like 6 months later for those to have a leak. Right. And so I guess that's like my main concern. Like I'm willing to believe in the certain assurances, but there's a certain genre of a reassurance that I've sort of come to distrust on these matters.
Okay. All right. Just writing down some of your questions there. So actually one other quick thing I should have said earlier. What about batteries? What about energy storage? Instead, sure, batteries are great. Energy storage is awesome. But we have to remember that our very best batteries last just for a few hours, and there may be days or even weeks on end where the wind isn't blowing, the sun isn't shining, or the wind is blowing too much. And so we have to turn off the turbines. In Japan, every year there is like a typhoon period where lasts for like 3-4 days, and you would have to, if you had an entirely variable renewable energy system powering Tokyo, you would have to have. Enough batteries to cover that gargantuan energy demand for just those 3 days. So even if you were able to build such a system, which is technologically, we aren't there yet in terms of batteries, that is an enormous expenditure for just 3 days worth of use. In a capitalist system, obviously no private investor would want to do that, but even in a social system, it's still an irrational use of resources just for those 3 days, when over here we've got this other technology that where we don't have to worry about that. With respect to concerns around things like Fukushima, waste, et cetera, with nuclear. So straight out of the gate, what we have to understand is that there's no such thing as any energy system or energy technology or any technology for that matter that is 100% safe. Doesn't exist. So what you're looking for is one that is the most safe rather than something that is perfectly safe. And already, even taking into account disasters like Fukushima and Chernobyl. And now, also remember, zero people killed in Fukushima in this industrial accident, and a relatively small number of people were killed in Chernobyl. Nevertheless, and I would also argue that the Chernobyl incident was more a product of a decrepit, corrupt, authoritarian regime, the Stalinist regime, than any something in technology itself. But even taking into account those disasters, you measure the way that you could measure any sort of the safety of any energy system or energy would be the number of deaths per unit of energy, the deaths per kilowatt hour. And far and away, nuclear has the fewest deaths per kilowatt hour. It is lower even than solar. And one of the reasons that you might think, well, that's kind of crazy, where's the danger in solar? Well, because, you know, you have to, people have to climb roofs and stick solar panels on roofs, and sometimes people fall off them and injure themselves or even die. Similarly, solar panels involve the use of heavy metals such as lead, cadmium, a number of other heavy metals. And, of course, the processing of that involves exposure to the workers involved. And so there's a death profile associated with that as well. So, again, what we're looking for is not a purely safe, 100% safe energy system. We're looking for the safest energy technologies. And nuclear, far and away, wins that battle. In any case, it isn't as if we've stopped improving or improving the safety since this period. So I don't want to throw under the bus existing nuclear because it is already like ridiculously safe. But third generation fourth generation nuclear reactors literally can't melt down, and it isn't like, well, that's what you say, but maybe you haven't figured something out, and there's a possibility. What are called passive safety systems involve things like gravity to make sure that this is walk away safe. So even if there are no humans involved, the physical systems themselves, physical laws, basically turn off the fission process. For that system to fail, the only way that it would fail, it would be the same way that a ball could spontaneously run up a hill. It just can't happen. It's physically impossible for that to happen. So, as far as I'm concerned, the meltdown question is a box that has already been ticked. That is not an issue that we should be concerned about at all. And in fact, you know, in terms of the debate these days, most people, that isn't really their main concern. The main concern really is either about radiation or the waste. What do we do with nuclear waste? Let's deal with the radiation issue first. A lot of people are very, very scared about radiation, not realizing that light is radiation. That if you take a return flight from New York to London, you'll be exposed to more ionizing radiation than a lifetime's worth of the same exposure to a nuclear power plant worker. So it's about radiation is bad per se. It just depends, like, in what's the exposure level, what kind of radiation. And as I said, with respect to that single flight, the radiation danger is extraordinarily low. There are many activities that we engage in that are far more far greater exposure to ionizing radiation than living near a nuclear plant, than working in a nuclear plant for your entire lifetime. It's a non-issue. Finally, on the issue of waste. So we're taking uranium out of the ground and then processing it, or in some cases we don't need to process it, and then using it in nuclear power plants. And then once it's done, we can put it back down in the ground. Oops. Now, taking that out of the ground, did it cause any issues with respect to the biosphere? Not particularly. In fact, there is a sort of a natural reactive, I'd say, that exists in West Africa. It was a reserve of uranium that began self-fissioning. Now, because it was in a location that was like a formation, a geological formation that is very, 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 very stable and has been stable for billions of years, is basically excluded, for separated from the rest of the biosphere. So when we want to take our waste and put it back down in the ground, that is the sort of formation that we're looking for. A geological formation that is, again, has been stable for billions of years, utterly cut off from the biosphere, and we're good. And other possibilities are reprocessing the waste. That adds an additional expense. France does this at the moment, and then after the end of that processing period, the high level waste is. Instead of talking about tens of thousands of years before it could be, you know, held in your hand safely, we're now reducing it to about 300 years. So there's that. So again, I would say that the waste issue, whether we're burying it in the ground or we're processing it, as far as I'm concerned, there's really no issue with respect to any endangerment of the biosphere. But at the same time, we also have to that. Other energy processes, it's not as if other energy processes don't have their own waste streams that pose issues to the rest of the biosphere, to humans in particular. As I said, solar panels involve, the processing of them involves lead, cadmium, other heavy metals. At the end of their life cycle, they end up in garbage dumps, often in underdeveloped countries in Asia, and kids pick over these dumps looking for copper that can be reprocessed and sold. And of course, they're exposed to these heavy metals. Now, any defender of solar panels or the solar industry would say, yes, that might be true, but we can solve that problem. Excuse me, we can solve that problem. I didn't mean to burp at the solar panel. We can solve that problem through good regulation. I agree. But then that's the same sort of approach that we can do with nuclear. So it's a matter of, like, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. If you think that we can solve some of the sort of toxic waste issues with variable clean energy through regulation, we can do the same with nuclear.
Sorry, Matt, you had something?
I got a couple things if you want to go first, David.
Well, I mean, I just also, in addition to like the actual process, I wanted to talk a little bit, about what nuclear means, like for industry, because, you know, right here in Texas, there's a big solar explosion. And I think it's good, especially if you can find ways to do it that work at scale and aren't sort of creating a kind of boutique neoliberal like energy grid separate from everybody else. But one of the points I think social should pay a lot of attention to about nuclear versus even something like solar or wind is the permanency of good union jobs that can come with nuclear, right? Versus something that, you know, one of the problems, like the solar industry right now, working conditions are very poor, non-unionized, etc. And also, you know, you're only showing up in an area for a very short amount of time. So especially if you wanted to scale outside of just like the big cities and metro areas, right? It's hard to make those jobs sort of be local and like create development for the community versus the nuclear plant, which is like, that's not moving, down the street anytime in the near future, right? That has like a very, very serious planning potential of being able to say, okay, here's a community. We can create very stable, well-paying union jobs for folks versus something that's, as it works right now, it's sort of coming in to a community for a very short period of time and then moving on. But I think that like thinking about this labor question too is something that we should also be considering, in addition to just the, you know, the actual nuts and bolts of how much energy we're producing and how we're producing it.
Yeah, you've hit the nail on the head there. There are people who would say, well, anybody who's working in the solar sector or the wind sector, they need too, and they need decent wages too, and I would absolutely agree. But at the same time, we have to recognize, and any trade unionist will tell, that one has to be strategic and recognize that there are some industries that are more easily unionizable than other ones. Mm-hmm. That also that a union is not a magic wand that suddenly turns a $9, 12 $1 an hour unskilled job into $100,000 a year permanent position. This even, you know, the strongest union be able to transform that that job, this other kind of a job. And the reality is that the nuclear power plants, a friend of mine talks about the parking lot issue. Like if you go to a parking lot at a nuclear power plant, you're going to see dozens, hundreds of parking spots, because this is a very large workplace. Against it, if you unionize it, and there's an effort on the part of the employer to de-unionize it, it is much harder because just volume of workers at the workplace. Whereas a small workplace, it's harder to maintain the union there because there's constant turnover. If you just have a small handful of workers who are convinced to be against the union, you lose that job very quickly. With a large workplace, once you have a union, it's really hard to get rid of, which is one of the reasons, obviously, why employers fight tooth and nail against unionization in those workplaces in particular. Nuclear power plants create family-supporting, long community-supporting jobs that, if we know that we have to get rid of coal-fired plants, what if we drop in small modular reactors into those boiler systems, in allowing those communities to maintain themselves? What if we speak to the coal mining workers, and maybe they do need to move, but we can maintain mining jobs, the same sort of skill set with respect to the extraction of uranium or other minerals and materials needed for the clean transition, which also that's true for wind and solar as well. But this is a sort of package of ideas that a socialist needs to be thinking about very seriously with respect to the just transition. We can't just call our plan a just transition and then never really deliver on it. Workers in those sectors and the trade unions that represent them are very aware of the challenges that they face. And they have built endless, with 4 decades worth of promises of just transitions, not just with respect to decarbonization, but with anything. Of promises from smart talking fancy educated people from the coasts and never delivering it on it. There's been betrayal after betrayal after betrayal. It is no wonder that they do not trust discussions of a just transition and a Green New Deal, even though the very idea of a Green New Deal in the first place was to focus on ensuring that the frontline workers in the fossil sector were taken care of, that they would not bear the burden of the clean transition.
And I'm sorry, I'm just like, this is some criticism I've been lobbying to our own side here in Texas, that like a lot of times people have treated the just transition as like not really a commitment, but an answer to a question, if you get what I mean. You know, like it's in the sense that like the just transition has to go from being just like a slogan to like a real commitment for folks.
Yeah.
And if people are working in industries where they're seeing, like, you know, people who do organizing here in Texas are seeing what's going on with solar installation across the state, and it's bad. And the fact that they're able to negotiate special deals with the government to preclude them from, for example, public competition or where they're sourcing their things, or just being able to skirt basic work requirements and safety requirements for folks. Like, we need to be showing up right now instead of just saying we're going to flip a switch and we have a slogan here. Like, the just transition needs to be an actual commitment, because as you were saying, like, people are very well aware of the forces that they're up against. And the nice thing, though, is like, we do have solutions to these things, but we as a left need to get a lot smarter about promoting these and talking about what this actually looks like versus just like, we have like a nice policy proposal if you look on page 25 of, our Green New Deal handbook, right?
Yeah. We need to make sure that we are speaking to industrial unions from the very beginning, before we develop our Green New Deal plan. Not we come up with our Green New Deal plan in the boardrooms of some NGO or think tank or with some grad students, and then after that, as a second thought, say, okay, hey unions, what do you think about this? And then when we do that, and some industrial unions or transportation unions or energy sector unions push back and say, this wouldn't work, this wouldn't work, this wouldn't work, we don't like this, our response should not be, oh, they're just being very conservative. They've been bought off by the bosses. This is business unionism, which is what you always hear. When the building trades in California had a protest outside the Democratic Convention a couple of years ago against the Green New Deal, the response in some left-wing magazines was that these are just, okay, they're just conservative trade unionists. I'm not going to be saying that all workers, by dint of being workers, are automatically noble and visionary and everything they say is correct. I mean, that's just some vulgar workerism. No, but the point is that you shouldn't also go on the other, the flip side, and assume that any time that workers and their unions disagree with something that's come up and that's been developed in a think tank or NGO is because they're being conservative. It could possibly might possibly be that these workers, having a lifetime of experience in the very systems that you want to transform, are responding to your suggestions because they know them so well and say, this isn't going to work. Also, you're undermining our jobs by doing this. Meanwhile, over here, this thing that does also deliver this set of technologies or processes that also delivers a clean transition. In fact, if you look at the evidence, and we have because we know these systems very well, it will deliver much lower emissions and will work compared to your solutions. Meanwhile, we can both preserve our jobs or preserve the type of jobs that we can do. So a great example of this would be, I've lost track of how many times I've seen anti-aviation campaigners. There's the Extinction Rebellion in the UK. There's Plain Stupid from a few years ago, and now the Straight Stay Grounded campaign. All of them are trying to reduce or eliminate aviation. Even AOC's original FAQ on the Green New Deal included a section about eliminating aviation, replacing it with high-speed rail. Now, I think to her credit, she pulled that back, and I think this was produced by some staffer and didn't really think it through. But what we need to be talking about with respect to aviation, we need aviation, both for freight and for passengers, for migration, to be able to participate in national democracy. How are union delegates from Hawaii or Guam or Puerto Rico going to be able to participate in the national union meetings by sailboat to get to the mainland? There's this sort of, bizarrely, there's something of a sort of colonial mentality as well buried within this, just forgetting about Hawaii, forgetting about Guam, forgetting about Puerto Rico, and so on and so forth. But instead, what we should be doing is developing clean fuel, genuinely clean fuels, either whether we're talking about synthetic hydrocarbons or ammonia or pure hydrogen. There's a range of different options here, and I'm not going to be, I could spend an hour talking about their pros and cons. Never, the point being that there's a feasible path to genuinely clean aviation long haul. In addition, heavy transport shipping, we know that we can't electrify that. Ain't no charging stations in the middle of the Pacific. So in the process of producing clean fuels for aviation, we're also building an industry for the very necessary clean fuels for shipping. And by the way, if you're a pipe fitter or you have the skill set from the oil and gas sector, that is equally applicable in terms of skill set, pay, unionization, unionizability, unionization rates, or in principle could be, as the oil and gas sector. So the workers in the oil and gas sectors can see themselves in a low carbon economy in a way that they don't see themselves when all the activists talk about is we need to get rid of aviation and everybody should just bicycle everywhere and ride buses. I mean, I think bikes and buses are great, but obviously they're not the entirety of the story.
Yeah, and I mean, go ahead, Matt.
You go ahead.
Oh, I mean, I'm sort of itching to get to some of the subject matter in your book, but just trying to stick with nuclear for just a moment. Sure. And just, we don't have to spend too long on this because we have a lot else to get to. But one thing that is sort of worrying to me about the current state of play is because I've been very convinced about the need for nuclear for not just the immediate future, but also, you know, for the long term, to build up this kind of socialist future, which is a promise of like real abundance for working people, which is very different from the kind of liberal anti-growth mindset that we're starting to see. But we'll get into all that in a moment. Because what frightens me, though, is that instead of seeing nuclear growing right now, we're actually starting to see it start to contract in both this country and in Europe with some pretty serious consequences. So, I mean, maybe in just like, you know, a couple minutes, if you could just give people like a sense of what the current state of nuclear power is, both in the U.S. and maybe abroad, just so people can see, right, can understand just like how serious and how much movement in the anti-nuclear realm there has been over the past few years.
Sure. So basically everywhere that nuclear plants have closed, the energy that they produced has not been replaced by renewables. Overwhelmingly, it is produced by fossil fuels. If we look at Germany at the moment, struggling through a very severe energy crisis, in part as a result of the Ukraine war, instead of turning back on their nuclear power plants, they're restarting coal-fired power plants. In Belgium, the government is, it's a coalition government, but the energy minister is a Green Party minister, very anti-nuclear. They are turning off, as a result of that, they're turning off their nuclear power plants and building new natural gas plants. It's a world turned upside down, that the very people who are supposed to be leading the charge with respect to the fight against climate change are making it worse by being single-mindedly. They're more opposed to nuclear than they're in favor of fighting climate change. In New York, the closure of Indian Point, I can't remember the exact numbers off the top of my head, but it's something like 20% increase in carbon emissions over the previous year. Double check that. It's probably something slightly different from that as a result of the closure of that nuclear plant, because you need to maintain grid reliability. And in a world where, the sun doesn't shine, the wind doesn't always blow, in order to firm up that grid, to make it reliable, you have to depend on fossil fuels. There's some good news as well. South Korea has gone pretty much all in on nuclear as a result of just building the same design over and over and over again. The learning involved without using the same workers, they're driving the cost down in the same way that repeated production of solar panels and wind turbines has radically driven the cost curve down for those technologies. And that's basically what we need to be doing with nuclear here to keep the cost down with nuclear. The one thing I would say about cost, which is really useful to keep in mind, particularly from a left perspective, is the United States, Canada, Western Europe, as a result of neoliberalism and basically neoliberal fear of large grand projects delivered by the state, we've gotten out of the business of doing that. And that is primarily what is driving the costs up, because if you don't have a workforce that is used to building these things, they have to relearn it every single time, which increases the time it takes to build it, which increases the cost. Another sort of frustration that I regularly have on the green left is that where I don't think they're being left wing at all, I think they're being deeply neoliberal in this sort of automatic fear of mega projects. That anytime there's any mega project, they talk about cost overruns. They talk about the idea of the state domineering society. And I think in many respects, this just is a reflection of sort of Hayekian sort of neoliberal conceptions of what the state can and can't do. We should be absolutely aware that the state isn't automatically in the interest of working people if it isn't fully democratically controlled. But if it is, then it's, and let me put it another way, it's a necessary condition, not a sufficient condition. Yeah, I guess I think that's probably good in terms of response on the cost stuff and where we're at, the state of play with nuclear.
Yeah, because I mean, I will say that that was one of the questions I had, which is I see a lot of anti-nuclear, pro-renewable folks say, you know, just the cost. It's falling behind on the cost stuff. And, you know, it reminds me of an essay. I think it was anti-nuclear, but by Langdon Winner called, like, Do Artifacts Have Politics? And it talks about this nuclear plant. And it says, and the analysis is correct, I think I think I agree with you more about, like, nuclear. But his analysis was the existence of nuclear power implies the existence of state that is like in control of something like that and a workforce that is highly skilled and able to run that. And like, I think the difference we have is like, those are good things that we should working towards.
Absolutely. One of the great problems that we faced during the pandemic was the hauling out of state capacity. I mean, that's a piece of political jargon, but it basically means the ability of the state to do things. Good outcomes in the pandemic don't really map easily to a left-wing government or a right-wing government because of so much of this hollowing out of state capacity. In those locations where things did have relatively better outcomes, it was in those locations of the world where there had been some sort of retreat from neoliberalism or hauling out of state capacity, or there had never been a full sort of neoliberalization. So I'm talking about places like Taiwan or South Korea. Just to pivot here just for a second, those locations were hit by SARS-1 in around 2003-2004, and a lot of the assessments that were done after the end of that pandemic, that local pandemic, one of the sort of villains in the piece was identified as the part privatization of healthcare systems had fragmented those healthcare systems, making it much harder for them to respond. And one of the recommendations was to reverse course with respect to neoliberalization, to restore state capacity. Mm. And anyway, that's a bit of a shaggy dog story and pivoting away from the questions of energy.
That feels like a fairy tale. I got to jump in there, though. Like, seeing a country respond to something like that so responsibly and take like the actual lessons from it, is it feels like I'm watching a Disney movie.
I mean, we've got to understand. I mean, I think it would be too much to say that South Korea and Taiwan and a number of other sort of states in the region are social democracies. What I would say is that they have developed in a much more state interventionist way, and we should, on the left, have a look at what worked and what didn't work with that, in the same way that we often talk a lot about Norway and Sweden and Finland and Denmark and Canada. I think it's about time that we begin to consider some of the interesting things that have happened with economic planning in the free and democratic parts of Asia along those lines. Back to questions around cost and nuclear. One last thing I wanted to say is that it's not merely that the left should be embracing nuclear. Nuclear needs the left, precisely because nuclear is very, very cheap once it's up and running because of the incredible energy density of its fuel. The upfront capital costs are considerable, just as they are with hydroelectric dams. And so market actors are very reluctant to engage in that huge initial outlay of considerable costs, whereas the state is much more comfortable with that and could do it much more cheaply. So conventional nuclear really does need a strong state to make it work, even though over the long haul, it ends up being much cheaper. The reason that we talk about wind and solar being super, super cheap, it's true that they're super, super cheap at the moment for the service that they provide, but they do not provide the same service as hydroelectricity or nuclear or geothermal. Those three deliver clean electricity that's firm. The other provides clean electricity that is variable. And so it needs to be backed up with something. So the full cost, let me put it another way. We on the left are always aware of the difference between price and cost. The cost to society of something is often very different from the price in the marketplace. similar. Just because the price of wind and solar is very, very low doesn't mean that that captures the entirety of the cost to the system. If you have to back that up with something else, then that cost is much larger. And so the full cost of wind and solar has to include that backup. And once you do that, mm-hmm. then nuclear begins to be much more rational from a cost perspective.
One final thing I got.
Tiny last little thing with conventional nuclear with small modular reactors, which potentially could be built in factories on an assembly line. And then that is much more market friendly, let's say, because there's a lot less upfront capital investment required on the part of the company. We aren't there yet. That technology hasn't been delivered yet. I mean, it does exist in submarines and aircraft carriers and icebreakers and small modular reactor research reactors at universities. But in terms of at a commercial level, doesn't exist yet. And so we still need the state to take the to use economic planning to shepherd that from pilot projects and lab bench through to commercial viability. So once again, you still need a much more confident left-wing government that is perfectly at ease with using the levers of government to deliver something. So whatever we're talking about, whether we're talking about conventional nuclear, big scale, or small modular reactors, advanced reactors, we still nuclear needs the left as much as the left needs nuclear.
One final question just on, you know, sources for these minerals. Does it got to be uranium? I remember hearing a lot about thorium 5 or 6 years ago. Is that a possibility? What's the state of play there?
I mean, I don't think there's necessarily anything wrong with thorium. Thorium may be something that makes nuclear very attractive to a place like India, which has considerable thorium resources, not much in the way of uranium resources. But the one thing that I would just very quickly push back on is that there is an argument that we don't need to worry about uranium and all its bad issues because we have thorium instead. And, you know, uranium's fine. There's nothing really wrong with it. In this space, there are a lot of folks who will say, let's talk about small modular reactors instead of conventional nuclear because it solved all these issues and we won't have the pushback from the green left anymore. Or let's talk about thorium instead of uranium. Or let's talk about advanced geothermal, which is much more geographically available, instead of nuclear. And in each case, the partisans of those particular technologies think that once we explain how this particular new technology solves the issues that you worry about with respect to conventional nuclear or whatever it happens to be, that the opponents will say, oh, okay, yeah, that's fine. I'm happy with this. No. They were opposed for irrational reasons with respect to the first technology, which means that they will be opposed for irrational reasons for this other technology or this other technology, no matter what you come. Another one is people will talk about fusion instead of nuclear fusion instead of nuclear fission. thinking that the green left will finally say yes, that give the green light and that we're happy with nuclear fusion. No, because there are, it requires tritium. It's an isotope of hydrogen. I don't want to go into details of that about that. That is radioactive. It's very mildly radioactive, but it is radioactive. And so already you see the green left saying, no, we don't want fusion either. It's irrational. They don't care. It's not a technology that you can come up with that which makes them happy. Sorry. Maybe I'm a little bit too cynical there.
No, I could see how that way that conversation has played out. I see the patterns there.